It's great to have this opportunity to speak to you this afternoon. We've been traveling through upstate New York to meet with various communities in the region. And it's been a fun trip, pleasant trip, and as you can see, we've been blessed by spectacular weather. This afternoon, what I'm going to focus on is both the national and regional economic conditions and what the Fed is trying to do about those conditions, paying particular attention to the housing sector and conditions here in upstate New York. As always, what I have to say reflects my own views and not necessarily those of the Federal Open Market Committee or the Federal Reserve System. As many of you know, this is my first chance to speak at the University of Rochester in my role as president of the New York Fed. So I thought by way of introduction, I'd talk a little bit about what we do at the New York Fed and build on some of the remarks we made earlier. What makes my job so interesting? The New York Federal Reserve is part of the Federal Reserve System, America's central bank, which was created by Congress in 1913, so we're 3 days away from our centennial. With this act, Congress delegated to the Federal Reserve System the constitutional authority to manage the money supply and designed it to be decentralized, representative of all America, and independent of the political process. The Fed system is comprised of the Board of Governors in Washington, D.C. That's a federal agency led by Chairman Ben Bernanke, plus the 12 reserve banks that span the country, of which the New York Fed is one. The district overseen by the New York Fed includes New York, all of New York, the 12 northern counties of New Jersey, Fairfield County in Connecticut, and last but not least, Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands. Each reserve bank is autonomous. It has its own charter and a board of directors that's drawn from its district. But it's also overseen by the Board of Governors in Washington. The law that created the Federal Reserve made the Federal Reserve banks independent so we can make decisions in the national interest free from political pressure. That said, however, the Fed is accountable to Congress. Congress has set explicit goals with respect to monetary policy. The Fed is instructed to pursue the highest level of employment that's achievable, consistent with price stability. This objective is also often referred to as our dual mandate because it combines two goals, high employment and low and stable inflation. In order to promote these objectives, though, we also have to pay close attention to financial stability because without financial stability, as we've seen following this recent financial crisis, it's very hard to achieve our goals for jobs and inflation. The FOMC meets in Washington 8 times per year to deliberate and vote on monetary policy. We're going to have our meeting next week on Tuesday and Wednesday. And as the New York Fed president, I'm the vice chairman. One of the advantages of being the vice chairman and the New York Fed president, I get to vote at every meeting. At these meetings, the 19 members of the FOMC, if we're fully up to capacity, we actually are one short right now because there's one vacancy on the Board of Governors. The Board of Governors and the other Federal Reserve Bank presidents, we each discuss and present our views on the outlook for the economy and discuss what that means in terms of the implications for monetary policy. We take input from our research departments about what we think is going to happen in the future, but also we try to get a lot of information from our boards of directors, regional advisory councils, and conversations that we have with local businessmen, bankers, and other officials. You may know that one of my councils, the Upstate New York Regional Advisory Board, is designed specifically to provide us with timely information about what's happening in this area. And in this way, the decisions of the FOMC are informed not by developments in one single city or state, but really are informed by what's going on in the entire country, including upstate New York. One thing that makes my job particularly interesting at the New York Fed is we have some unique roles within the Federal Reserve. So I want to tell you a little bit about some of them that make the Federal Reserve Bank of New York a little bit different than the other reserve banks. First, we're the eyes and ears of the Fed on Wall Street, and we supervise many of the largest financial institutions in the country and in the world. We operate FedWire, which is a conduit for transferring large money payments between the different banks. We provide banking service to the U.S. Treasury. For example, we conduct all the U.S. Treasury auctions on behalf of the Treasury Department. And we provide services to central banks and governments around the world. For example, if you go to the New York Fed, you can actually take a tour of our gold vault, which has the most gold of any repository in the world, and we hold that gold for foreign governments around the world. We also have a pretty diverse district, as I mentioned. We have the urban density of Manhattan to the
forested Spartanus of the northern Adirondacks, the Caribbean islands of Puerto Rican and the Virgin Islands, and of course a lot of the natural beauty of this region, you know, the Finger Lakes region, which I had the benefit of being able to visit this weekend. My wife is a Cornell alumni, so it doesn't take a lot of work to twist her arm and make a trip to upstate New York. Now, let me talk a little bit about the crisis and the Fed's response to the crisis. You know, of course, these are anything but normal times. The financial crisis that began in the middle of 2007 and intensified dramatically following the failure of Lehman Brothers has been the most violent since the Great Depression. It was followed by a long and deep recession, the longest and deepest since World War II, and many of us are now referring to it as the Great Recession. The Fed responded aggressively and creatively in an effort to pursue our dual mandate of full employment and price stabilities. And what we did really fell into two broad buckets in terms of our response. First, we took steps to supply liquidity to the financial system so that the financial markets would continue to function properly and enable households and business to continue to maintain their access to credit. Carrying out an age-old central banking role, we loaned funds to financial firms secured by high-quality collateral. Traditionally, in the past, we've only made such loans to depository institutions such as commercial banks. But in fact, the modern U.S. financial system has a lot of other lenders that supply credit to the economy. And these companies and markets are also important in terms of credit creation in our economy. So the Federal Reserve many years ago was given authority by Congress to make emergency loans to non-banks in, quote, unusual and exigent circumstances, unquote. During the crisis, we found that when markets not functioning and banks not willing to lend on to these non-bank financial entities, we had to exercise that authority to provide liquidity to the market more broadly. A handful of times, we made the very difficult decision to make emergency loans to prevent the disorderly failure of particular firms. We did not do this because we wanted to help those particular firms, but because allowing them to collapse in a disorderly way in the midst of a global crisis would have disrupted the financial system, wrecked the U.S. economy, and harmed households and businesses throughout the United States. All the Fed's loans were collateralized, and we are highly confident they will all be repaid in full. In fact, the track record to this point is the Federal Reserve has not lost a penny. Credit losses are zero. And we've actually made a lot of money. That wasn't the intention of our activities, but we've actually made a lot of money, which we have turned over to the Treasury Department. Some of our employees are somewhat unhappy that we don't have more profit sharing. Second, we took aggressive steps to ease monetary policy in order to support economic activity and employment. By the end of 2008, we reduced short-term interest rates to virtually zero, the lowest level in the history of the Federal Reserve. And in order to provide still further support to the economy, given that we couldn't push interest rates below zero, we bought more than $1.5 trillion of long-term assets, principally mortgage bonds guaranteed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, with the support of the U.S. Treasury between December 2008 and March 2010. Now, when the Fed buys these long-term assets, what it does is it pushes down long-term interest rates. We think this is actually helpful in sort of supporting the economy because it supports the economy in a number of ways. It makes housing more affordable. It supports consumption because households can refinance their mortgages now at lower interest rates. In addition, low long-term rates reduce the cost of capital for business, thereby encouraging them to invest and hire more employees and spend money on equipment, construction, machinery, for example. So where are we today in terms of the outlook? Well, let me start my discussion of economic conditions with a few comments about the national outlook. As I discussed in a recent speech, the Great Recession has been followed by what we would characterize to be a tepid recovery. Since 2009, economic activity has grown, but not robustly. In recent months, the momentum has, in fact, slowed. After rising at a little bit more than a 3% annual rate during the second half of 2009, real gross domestic product growth is now growing, we would guess, a little around 2% or so. We'll see the precise number when we get the third quarter figures later this week. So why are we experiencing this soft patch right now? There are several reasons why the economy has slowed. First, in the first year of a recovery, typically the economy gets quite a bit of a boost from inventories. In the recession, companies liquidate inventories, and then when the recovery starts, they start to replenish those inventories. And that swing from inventory liquidation to replenishment provides a tremendous boost to economic activity. Well, unfortunately, that effect is now beginning to peter out. Second, the gross impulse from the 2009 fiscal stimulus package, still positive, but a lot less positive now than it was 6 to 12 months ago. And third, the usual handoff that we typically see at this point in the economic cycle, the handoff from inventory-led growth to private demand-led growth, has not yet been fully established. Instead, we have ongoing sluggishness in two key sectors that have typically led past recoveries, consumer spending and housing. The slow recovery we've seen in consumer spending and housing in the face of very substantial monetary policy and fiscal policy stimulus really reflects the painful unwinding of the dynamics at work that occurred during the expansion that preceded the Great Recession. Beginning in around 2003, underwriting standards for residential mortgages were significantly relaxed, and that led to a sharp rise in household borrowing and in home prices. The rise in home prices, in turn, helped support more borrowing as households used lines of credit and second mortgages to tap into their growing home equity. This fueled a strong boom in home construction. But unfortunately, home price increases could not be sustained without limit. When home prices peaked and started to turn down, the shoddy underwriting practices got exposed for what they were. The dynamic linking home prices, credit, and consumption all went into reverse. So let's consider what this first means for consumption. Consumption of goods and services rose at a slow 2% annual rate over the first half of 2010. And there's really no sign of much strengthening since then. Several factors are inhibiting families from spending. They include job and income losses, low confidence, declines in wealth as real estate and stock prices have dipped. Households are also saving more and paying down their debts. And of course, lenders have played a role by tightening underwriting standards for credit relative to what the standards were pre-recession. The key question that we face in looking at the consumption outlook is, have households completed their deleveraging or is there still more to go? Although we believe that substantial progress has been made, it's hard to tell how much farther this course has to run. So now let's consider why housing market activity, both in terms of new construction and sales, remains depressed as well. One reason for this is that many existing homes stand vacant. We estimate that there are roughly 3 million more vacant homes than usual in the market. The stock of vacant homes will shrink when foreclosures start to fall and more empty homes are sold or rented out, but this is a big overhang right now on the housing market. On the sales side, even though low mortgage rates and falling home prices have boosted housing affordability to the highest level in 40 years, this is a good time to buy a house from an affordability perspective. The current pace of sales is still very sluggish. Impediments to home sales include tight lending standards, a weak job market, and continued uncertainty about whether the drop in home prices is over or not. Importantly, the large drop in home prices that we saw between 2006 and 2008 have also reduced homeowners' equity significantly. This makes it harder for people to trade up to a nicer home because they don't have the down payment to facilitate that transaction. In fact, with lower home prices, many families now owe more on their mortgages than what their homes are worth. This means they cannot easily refinance their mortgages or sell their homes if they experience a crisis such as job loss or serious illness. Right now, foreclosure completions, so the end of the foreclosure process, are at an all-time high, although the good news is that the initiation of new foreclosures may finally be slowing. Recently, attention has been focused on cases where some of the documentation used in the foreclosure process may have been flawed. The Fed actively encourages efforts to find viable alternatives to foreclosure. Not many people know this, but a team of New York officials work with mortgage counselor and community activists to support distressed homeowners, and our lawyers support legal aid programs for people facing foreclosure. At the same time, it's important that the foreclosures that comply with the law can ultimately take place. This is a necessary part of returning the housing market to more normal conditions. Although along with two other agencies, the Fed is reviewing right now the foreclosure practices at the major bank mortgage servicers. We are also keeping an eye on banks' potential liabilities, where they've made representations about the mortgages bought by investors that may not have been correct in all cases. We want to ensure that the housing finance business is supported by robust back office operations for processing of new mortgages as well as foreclosures, so that home buyers and investors have full confidence in the process. We are monitoring developments in this area closely in order to evaluate any potential impact on housing or financial markets and on the overall economy. So now let me turn to economic conditions in upstate New York. It's no secret that this region has struggled with weak economic growth and population loss in recent decades. The region has experienced some very painful economic restructuring, particularly as it's lost so many of its high-paying manufacturing jobs. Yet the process has yielded a productive and more diversified economy with a larger service sector. For this and other reasons I will discuss, the upstate New York economy has actually weathered the Great Recession relatively well. While the upstate economy generally underperformed the nation during the 1980s and 1990s, its recent experience has been quite different. During the Great Recession, upstate New York's job losses began later than for the United States as a whole, and those losses were generally less severe when they took place. The relatively strong economic performance of the region of late is also clearly tied to its stable housing markets. Upstate New York's relatively slow economic performance and lack of population growth during the expansion of 2000 supported only modest increases in home prices and sales during the housing boom. So the region missed out on the housing boom. The good news, though, is by missing out on the housing boom, it missed out on most of the housing bust. When home prices and sales began to decline quite rapidly in many parts of the region in the nation, they held steady across upstate New York. As a result, upstate New York has been largely spared the boom and bust cycle that we've seen in other parts of the country. In fact, many of New York State, upstate New York's metropolitan regions even experienced home price appreciation during the housing boom, making these places among the best performing in the country during this period. Many parts of the country have experienced severe housing busts with sharp drops in housing-related activity, such as construction, purchase of major appliances. For example, in places like California and Florida, construction jobs grew to be a very large share of employment. And when construction employment plummeted during the recession, these jobs were lost, which really hurt those economies. This dynamic did not occur in places like Rochester, where the housing sector was small in the first place, and thus there were very few jobs to lose. Another part of the story is that homeowners in upstate New York did not take on much debt. As a result, households here are much less strained than elsewhere. One reason is the home prices did not appreciate very rapidly, so people didn't actually have to stretch to buy their homes. The homes remained affordable. Moreover, there was much less penetration of risky subprime mortgages into the region's housing markets. So upstate New York's home loans have generally performed better than elsewhere in the country, with fewer delinquencies and fewer foreclosures. Indeed, much of this region was spared a lot of the bad effects that were associated with the non-prime mortgage boom and bust. So the upstate economy has actually performed quite well in this respect. As a large and growing sector, local colleges and universities have surely also contributed to the region's economic stability over the past few years. Indeed, the University of Rochester provides a clear example of how a university can play a key role in its local economy. The benefits of higher education go beyond their direct economic contributions, such as employment and spending. For a very important reason, they can increase the region's stock of human capital. That's the total supply of knowledge and the skills of its workforce. And a region's human capital contributes importantly to the region's economic success and resiliency. The educational activities of a region's colleges and universities help build the skills of the local workforce. In addition, the knowledge created by colleges and universities through research activities can play a key role in supporting startup new businesses. Businesses can use university expertise, infrastructure, and research findings to help them develop cutting-edge products and services. Furthermore, universities often employ local businesses to develop and commercialize products that rise from their research activities. This dynamic is a very positive one that can expand local economic activity and consequently create new jobs for high-skilled workers in the regions. Institutions such as the University of Rochester, in my view, play a vital role of this sort in the upstate economy.
The diversification of Rochester's economy has also helped the region weather the Great Recession. In particular, the major investments in the University of Rochester Medical Center have allowed healthcare and education sectors to expand and become an increasingly important part of the local economy. These sectors tend to provide stability to their local economies because they're less susceptible to contraction during economic downturns compared to other sectors of the economy. Moreover, despite the decline in manufacturing, Rochester is still very well known for its world-class optics and imaging business cluster. Local businesses work closely with the University of Rochester and the Rochester Institute of Technology to leverage their joint expertise in fields such as imaging technology and lenses to develop cutting-edge products. As a result, Rochester has remained a highly productive and relatively stable region. So now let me turn to the issue of what is the Fed doing now. As I discussed, since the beginning of the downturn, the Fed has actively used monetary and regulatory policy to help support economic activity and improve economic outcomes, both here in Rochester and across the nation, relative to what had happened, what would have happened if we hadn't intervened in that respect. With regard to monetary policy, the Fed has in place a very highly accommodative stance. And the FOMC has said that it will keep short-term rates at exceptionally low levels for an extended period of time. The Fed also retains large amounts of mortgage-backed bonds on its portfolio that were acquired to support the housing market and help bring down mortgage and other long-term interest rates to the historical low rates in place that we see today. The FOMC and the chairman have stated their commitment to take further actions to bring interest rates down further should economic conditions warrant. In a recent speech, I said that both the current levels of unemployment and inflation and the time frame over which they are likely to return to levels consistent with our mandate are unacceptable. I said that I thought further Fed action was likely to be warranted unless the economic outlook were to evolve in a way that made me more confident we would see better outcomes for both employment and inflation before too long. Turning to regulatory policy, the biggest lesson of the financial crisis is that severe financial disruptions can inflict very large and persistent costs on people's lives and jobs. Over the past year, with Fed leadership and support, important new regulatory initiatives have been advanced to create a global financial system where players cannot slide back into risky business as usual, the type of activities that created this crisis. These include the recent agreement with international bank regulators, sometimes called Basel III, to impose stricter standards for globally active banks with respect to liquidity and capital, and the considerable regulatory changes that are embodied in the Dodd-Frank Act that was passed by Congress this summer. These measures recognize that to avert or contain future financial crises, we need a financial system that can withstand relatively large negative shocks. First, market participants must not have incentives to take excessive risk. Instead, incentives should reward actions that support economic growth and contribute to financial stability. And financial firms must set aside enough capital and liquidity so that when things go wrong, they can absorb losses with their own resources. Finally, if these buffers prove inadequate and a financial firm does veer towards failure, the official sector needs the tools to wind them down in an orderly manner without having to make the terrible choice between a chaotic failure that harms the overall economy versus a taxpayer-funded rescue. So in conclusion, I want to thank you all for giving me the opportunity to talk to you today about a little bit about what the New York Federal Reserve does, how it ties into your lives, how we care about what happens here. There are a lot of links between us and you. How the Fed's dual mandate for full employment and stable prices guides our actions and affects your prospects. How we rely on the economic conditions in upstate New York as an input for when we formulate our monetary policies. And how our efforts to restore financial stability have provided a more solid foundation for lending to households and businesses, including small businesses. So to summarize conditions at the moment, after a recession that was milder in upstate New York than in many parts of the country, the region is showing signs of a modest recovery. A more diversified, more knowledge-based economy and a relatively small housing sector helped to limit the recession's impact on many communities in this region. Nevertheless, the Great Recession did spread much pain throughout this region, and unemployment here remains much higher than we would like. The Fed cannot wave a magic wand and make the problems remaining from the preceding period of excess vanish immediately. We'd like to, but we can provide essential support for the needed adjustments. Even with our best efforts, the road to full recovery here in upstate New York and across the nation is likely to be long and bumpy. But I am confident that we will make it. And the dynamicism that's represented in this room, the private sector combined with academic learning and research, will provide a strong underpinning for our future economic prosperity. Thank you very much for your very kind attention, for being here today. I'd be very happy to take a few questions. Before we begin with questions, one small ground rule. We are now in what's called the Federal Open Market Committee blackout period because we have a FOMC meeting next Tuesday. So if you ask me anything about monetary policy or the national economic outlook, I will give you a very careful answer, or I won't answer the question at all because I want to be faithful to the rules of that blackout.
How has the board started to change rule life?
Well, it's made our lives very, 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 very busy. The question is about the Dodd-Frank Act and what's been taking place abroad in Basel in terms of how it's affecting what we're doing and what are the pieces of the Dodd-Frank Act that we view as really, really important. The Dodd-Frank Act represents about 2,000 pages of legislation that we're going to turn into many, many more thousand pages of rules and regulations. So we have to go from the intent of Congress to actually make this work on the ground for businesses and financial firms. And this is going to be a very, very challenging thing to do over the next 12 to 24 months, to do it in a way that achieves the goals of achieving a more robust and resilient financial system, but does so in a way that ensures the flow of credit to households and businesses, doesn't crimp the flow of credit to households and businesses. Now, with respect to the Dodd-Frank Act and what's been taking place internationally in Basel, I think there's a couple of things that I would argue are the most important pieces. You know, if we wanted to talk about all the legislation, I would be here for several hours. The first piece that I think is hugely important is higher capital and liquidity standards, especially for large, globally active financial institutions. This is really, really important because if they have more capital and more liquidity, they can withstand bigger shocks without actually turning to the Federal Reserve or the taxpayer for assistance. You know, what we'd like to see is we don't think we're going to prevent future financial crises. There'll still be financial crises. But when they occur, we want the ability of banks to still be able to access the capital markets and raise more capital, replenish the capital that's been lost in the financial crisis, rather than be so much in distress that they can no longer access the capital markets. Bit higher capital and liquidity buffers will make that more feasible going forward. The second thing that we've done is we've created a resolution regime for non-bank financial institutions that we did not have before the crisis. One of the reasons why the Fed was put in a difficult position of making a very Hobson's choice with respect to some non-bank financial institutions was the fact there was no resolution regime for major non-bank financial institutions that allowed them to be wound down in an orderly way. The Dodd-Frank Act creates such a resolution regime for such non-bank financial companies that will be administered by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Now, we don't yet know how well this will work in practice. We don't know how well it will apply, especially to firms that operate around the world in many different jurisdictions. So it's not clear that this is necessarily going to solve all our ills, but it's a very, very important step, something that we did not have over the last few years. The third thing that I think is very, very important about the Dodd-Frank Act is it really is going to increase the transparency into some of the more opaque parts of the securities market. The over-the-counter derivatives market was a market that where the amount of business that was being done was not very well known. The price of the transactions was not very well known. This created uncertainty about what exposures were, created therefore uncertainty about whether firms were in good shape or not so good shape. The Dodd-Frank Act is going to basically provide a lot more transparency into this market by requiring that OTC derivatives contracts be standardized whenever possible and cleared through central counterparties. This will reduce risk and it will increase transparency, and so it will remove one of the sources that propagated the shocks that we saw in the financial crisis throughout the system.
There's a lot of other things in the Dodd-Frank Act, so I'll leave it there, recognizing this is a very incomplete list in terms of the very important pieces that are in the Dodd-Frank Act that will make the financial system more secure. The question is with respect to what are the consequences of this problem of underwater mortgages, where people have a mortgage that is worth more than the value of their home? Well, I think it does have some negative economic consequences. It makes it very difficult for people to take advantage of lower mortgage rates and refinance their homes. It makes it very difficult for these people to move from one home to another, and that can be important if they want to follow job opportunities in another region. Increases over time, it tends to increase the number of actual foreclosures as people say it's just not worth it to try to pay on this mortgage because the mortgage is worth more than our home. So it's definitely a negative in terms of the economic outlook. There's not that much the Federal Reserve can do about it in the sense that this is between the borrower and the lender, but what we have tried to do is encourage mortgage restructuring whenever possible, because oftentimes this can be a win-win for both the borrower and the investor. Foreclosure is a very difficult, painful, and costly process, and so whenever there's a situation where you can restructure the mortgage and avoid the foreclosure, in many of those instances you'll find out you'll actually do better than going through the foreclosure process. So we're encouraging that wherever that's practical.
Bill. I'm not going to really answer that question in any great detail because I think it gets a little too close to monetary policy and the type of things that we're going to be thinking about next week. I will say, though, that the different people on the Federal Open Market Committee have different views about how our actions will affect financial asset prices more broadly, and those views about how financial asset prices respond will influence their views of the costs and benefits of any particular set of actions.
I was wondering, first of all, thank you for coming. I was wondering if you have a view of a potential conflict between the regional aspects of a Federal Reserve president and the central aspects for monetary policy.
Well, I guess, I think that at the end of the day, I think that we don't want to be real parochial and sort of, run monetary policy just for our region. I think we really do want to represent the country. That said, the input that we get from the regional, what's going on in the region, and we sort of put that together as we sit around the FOMC table, does definitely inform our decision making. So I think, I think that the presidents need to think about what everybody is saying around the table about put all the pieces of the puzzle together, rather than conduct policy on a sort of a parochial region by region basis. I don't think that would be such a great idea, because then you'd have it'd be very, very hard to achieve consensus. I mean, you can imagine then someone saying, well, my region looks great, so let's tighten monetary policy, while someone else would say my region looks lousy, so let's ease monetary policy. I think it'd be very hard to come to a consensus on that basis. So I think it's more about being informed about what's going around the entire country. That's what the regional reserve banks, I think, really bring to the table when we have that discussion about the economic outlook at the FOMC meetings. I think in the medium to long run, we're going to be fine. One of the things that I've been thinking a lot about in this trip through upstate New York is what are the strengths of the United States, in the medium to longer term. And we shouldn't undersell those strengths. And some of the strengths, for example, represented here in New York, in upstate New York, is we have the world-class higher education. Any country in the world would give their eye teeth to have something even half as good as what we have in terms of higher education. That's one huge positive. Another huge positive is a culture of entrepreneurship. Most countries would be really well served if they had the kind of cultural support of entrepreneurship that we have. There's not that many countries in the world where someone can go from scratch to be a billionaire in a few short years.
So there, you know, there's tremendous opportunities here. And the other thing I think is just the creativity on the technology side. I mean, we think of all the innovations around the world. So people have asked me on this trip. They said, "Well, what can the U.S. compete with?" Well, we can compete on a lot of levels. I mean, one thing we can sell is educational services to foreign students. There's a heck of a lot of people that would love to be educated in the United States. Another thing we can sell is services, for example, media. If you go around the world, turn on a television set on your travels and ask yourself how many of those programs are U.S. programming as opposed to programming from other countries. We dominate in a whole bunch of areas. So I think that it's important when we're going through tough times not to get too discouraged. There are a lot of things that make the U.S. Special in very good ways, and I think that it's going to take a little time to dig ourselves out, but I think we're going to be fine in the medium to longer term.
Let me just do a follow-up question. One question, new technologies.
Well, I would say two things about manufacturing. First of all, manufacturing employment as a share of overall employment has been shrinking for decades. It's been shrinking during booms. It's been shrinking during busts. So we should just, and the main reason for this is because productivity in manufacturing is very high relative to productivity in the rest of the economy. So if your productivity is going up very rapidly, you need fewer workers. That's actually a good thing, not a bad thing. I think that what's going to happen over time is manufacturing is probably going to continue to shrink as a share of overall economic activity. But what also is going to happen is the mix of manufacturing is going to move from lower tech manufacturing to higher tech manufacturing. As part of this trip, we were in Ithaca, and we went to visit a company called Kaonix. This is a manufacturing enterprise just outside of Ithaca. And what do they manufacture? Well, they manufacture these chips that basically sense the position of devices so that if you have an iPhone and you turn the iPhone from upright to sideways, you'll notice the picture will swing along with it. Well, there's a little microchip in there that makes that happen. They expect to sell something like 80 million chips this year. And if you look at the chart of their sales, it looks sort of like this. So that's the kind of new technology that I think that will contribute to manufacturing jobs here in the United States. And this is why the partnership between the university research and business, I think, is so important, because where are these cutting-edge technologies going to come from? Well, some of them will be developed by business, but some of them will come out of the universities. In the case of Kaonix, it came out of Cornell faculty research that really took place about 30 years ago. So it took about 30 years from the research stage where the invention was made for this to actually be commercialized, and now we sort of see the hockey stick takeoff of this activity.
How do we overcome that?
Well, it's very difficult because obviously, just like we would really resent if other countries told us how we should have our labor standards and our environmental standards, they are going to very much resent us telling them what their labor standards and environmental standards should be. So I think that's actually a difficult conversation to have. I think that the key here is to have exchange rates that are flexible enough to reflect underlying competitiveness. So if a country is more competitive, maybe because they do have not as rigorous OSHA environmental standards, that over time that their currency would be able to appreciate to reflect that increased competitiveness. And this is something that the G20 leaders over the last week have been wrestling with. Obviously, the countries that are very competitive are reluctant to give up this advantage. But I think even they understand that over the medium to longer term, there does need to be a global rebalancing. More exports, less consumption, more exports from the United States. Less exports, more consumption in the emerging markets. And for that rebalancing to take place, a little bit more exchange rate flexibility is probably going to be an important piece of that. Well, I mentioned a very important positive, which was higher education. One of the negatives is we're not very good at primary and secondary education. And, in part that stemmed from the fact that back, 40, 50 years ago, women were discriminated against in the workforce. So a disproportional share of very, very smart women went into the teacher route And so we had really, really high quality teachers. So ironically, as we've opened up opportunities for women in the workforce, we've actually degraded the quality of our teachers to some degree, I think. So I think we need to figure out a way of, you know, upgrading the quality of teachers, spending the resources to have, you know, small enough class size. I mean, I think everybody in this room probably can, you know, knows that the difference between a really good teacher and an average teacher is huge. There's, I mean, I think everybody has two or three teachers in their lives that really, really affected their career, affected how they thought about life, affected, you know, how they thought about learning. And to the extent that we could get more of those teachers to motivate students, I think we would, you know, we would be well served.
Again, in light of your another response to your comment a little bit ago, at the G20, Secretary Gardner made a proposal that, I mean, it would seem that there's no particular reason for people to sign on to that and to actually agree to that proposal. So I guess I'm asking what his a political motivation putting the proposal out that he was pretty certain wasn't going to be picked up. Can you speculate a little bit about what he hoped to get out of putting that on the table?
No.
I thought that might be your answer, but I thought I'd ask.
I'm going to leave the Treasury negotiations to the Treasury. Thanks. Tim's a very good negotiator. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.